This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
Most of the time on this program, I feel like I can hold my own in most discussions. There are some topics, however. Take menopause. Whenever we talk about this part of a woman's life, I feel like half the audience is saying, yeah, what do you know about it? That's why I call on smart people to help me.
I like to refer to their emotional state as an emotional tornado because their moods are fluctuating widely, frequently, unpredictably.
On today's Health Show, we'll talk about menopause, or more accurately, perimenopause.
We'll also hear the story of a Midwestern farming family who solved financial and health problems by going organic, and hear why there is discussion going on about certain medical practice guidelines. I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Health Show. This year, about 60 million American women between the ages of 39 and 53 will become perimenopausal. Nearly half will show signs of clinical depression and anxiety disorders associated with the onset of perimenopause. In her new book, The Fifth Decade, Is This Just My Life or Is It Perimenopause?, Dr. Deborah Wagner offers women and their families a guide to the phases that define the turbulent years of perimenopause, as well as insight to navigate the intense, unpredictable emotional swings that define the dreaded change. Dr. Wagner and I spoke recently, and we started by talking about the misuse of the word menopause.
Yes, perimenopause is the 3 to 10 years that precedes menopause. Menopause is really a momentary event. Menopause is when a woman has not had her period for a year, then she's in menopause, and immediately thereafter she's in postmenopause.
So it's just that 1 second in time and then you're done?
Pretty much, yeah.
Now, how has our understanding changed? I mean, how much have we really learned about this over the past, say, 10, 20 years?
I would say most of the learning has been done in the last 10 or so years. Before that, there was very, very little information available for women. And more is coming out now as more research is being done. But a lot of women, and even more men than women, don't know anything about it.
In your book, you share a lot of great stories from different people. How did you find these people and get acquainted with their stories?
Well, a lot of people I know through social means, some through my practice, some family. Being that I'm in that age range, there are a lot of people that I rub elbows with that have been talking. And as I talked more and more about my book, people were more and more willing to come forth with their stories.
In the book, you also talk about the 4 stages of perimenopause. Walk us through those, if you could.
Well, the first stage is perimenopausal initiation, and that's when perimenopause is just beginning. Usually women don't even understand that they're in perimenopause because the symptoms really are under the radar. And that can begin as early as the late 30s, early 40s. Women might see some very minimal changes in their menstruation. PMS is getting a little bit worse, but on the emotional front, they're finding that their threshold for tolerating unpleasantness is a little bit lower than it ever was before. After perimenopausal initiation, they start to go into stage 2, which is emotional disruption. And that's when something being off really is on the radar. That's now when women start to consciously realize that they're feeling more distressed, that their emotional fuse is shorter. The daily stresses and challenges of life create much more of a reaction in her. She might find herself impatient with her job or her husband or her children. In terms of her menstrual cycle, she's seeing more fluctuations. She may find cramping in the middle of her cycle. And now what enters the picture is a lowering of libido. Women start to really feel different about their sexual relations with their partners. So in emotional disruption, things are really starting to get a little bit dicey. Then they get into the worst stage of perimenopause, which is stage 3 turbulence. Now they're deeply in the throes of the menopausal transition. Their hormones are all over the place, up and down, vacillating wildly. I like to refer to their emotional state as an emotional tornado, because their moods are fluctuating widely, frequently, unpredictably, and it's not just before they get their period, it's throughout the entire monthly cycle, if there is even a cycle. Psychologically, we see a lot of anxiety and depression in this stage, and it's often not understood that this is attributable to the hormonal imbalance, which is what my greatest concern is. Some women who have had anxiety or depression before they started their hormonal changes now get into serious trouble because everything intensifies. So you might see women with panic attacks, with severe depression. They start to suffer from insomnia, turbulent dreams, and on the libido front, it's pretty much gone. All hope is not lost, because then they get into stage four, which is quietude, and that's when the hormones really start to stabilize at a much lower level. Menstruation is ending, moods start to calm down, anxiety and depression are alleviated, and they start to feel their sexual drive again, although it's not as sexually driven, but more sensually driven. And women in stage four quietude often find that the after is even better than the before, because they feel more self-assured, they feel stable internally, and have a new sense of themselves.
Plus, you know, at that point, they've come out the other side, and it's like, whew, we made it.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of husbands are saying the same thing.
Well, it's interesting, because in your book, you do have a section for men, which is kind of unique in a book like this. And was it interesting talking to men about the topic?
Well, it was very interesting talking to men. And the reason why I put in that section is because I've had so many male patients who have come in and said, what's going on with my wife? You know, she's not herself. This is not the woman I married. You know, she doesn't want sex. She doesn't want to be near me. She's yelling at me all the time. She's depressed. I don't recognize her. So I felt that men really need to become informed about these changes just as much as women do, because if men don't understand that this is a hormonal change that women don't want to be going through, they don't want to feel the way they feel, then they might take it very personally. And that can really be disruptive for a relationship.
One of the chapter names in that section is, "Okay, I will take directions, just tell me what to do." I love that. That was great.
Thank you.
I have felt that way in my life. Talk about some of the actual physical changes.
Right. Well, there are changes in how she digests food. There are changes in what foods and substances she can tolerate. For example, you might have a woman who was accustomed to having 3-4 cups of coffee a day. Now, if she has one cup of coffee at 9 a.m., she actually may not have processed the caffeine when she goes to bed at night. So her whole system is changing. Her hair will change. It will become drier and more brittle. Her skin becomes less elastic, and she might, during perimenopause, have breakouts of rosacea. Her figure changes as the female hormones that originally caused the womanly shape now start to disappear. Her waist will thicken, and she'll gain weight much more easily. So there are a lot of changes in her body, and women don't understand that this is all part of the hormonal changes that go on.
You talk, too, about the relationship between estrogen and the thyroid, and how going through perimenopause may put a strain on some thyroid health.
A lot of women develop thyroid problems. Typically, it's hypothyroidism, which means that the thyroid gets sluggish, largely due to the loss of progesterone as you progress through perimenopause, which helps support healthy thyroid function. And that can create symptoms that are very similar to depression. So when women all of a sudden start to feel sluggish and tired, and they lose some of their luster for life, it can be due to the hormonal changes, but it could also be due to the changes in the thyroid, so it can become a very blurred picture.
It appears you don't spend much time in the book talking about hormone replacement therapy. Why is that?
Well, hormone replacement therapy is not the most popular resolution to hormonal changes of perimenopause right now. And that is because there was a 15-year study called the Women's Health Initiative that was actually stopped before it was finished because they found that in this study, when they gave women hormone replacement therapy, they were at much higher risk for heart problems, certain types of cancer, pulmonary embolism, and it was so dangerous that they stopped the study before they had completed it. You know, there are some questions now about how the study was done and who was included in the study, but it was such a scary outcome that hormone replacement therapy was really taken off the table as the first and best solution.
We do hear reports about puberty beginning earlier in girls. Is perimenopause beginning earlier in women?
Actually, there's no evidence that it's beginning earlier. The reasons for puberty beginning earlier in girls is believed to be due to the estrogens that we're all getting in our food supply and even in toxic forms, like in terms of pesticides and whatnot. And a lot of these chemicals act like estrogen in the body, and that's what's bringing on puberty earlier. Most milk, most meats, you know, animal products are from animals that were injected with estrogen or estrogen-like hormones to fatten them up. And we get this in our food supply. So that's really the reason for earlier puberty in girls.
If there was anything that a couple would complain about during this, it seems to me it would be trying to get a good night's sleep.
Yes. That is absolutely one of the huge challenges because as women go through perimenopause and they start to have the infamous night sweats, they're awakening at night and tossing and turning, and that affects their spouse. I've heard stories of men who have to go to bed with gloves and socks and long underwear on because their wives are lowering the temperature in the house so low that they're like popsicles. It can be a little humorous if you look at the light side of it, but yes, it does affect sleep quite a bit.
Okay, well, it seems like, you know, trying to get through all this, it's a lot of communication between woman and doctor, woman and spouse, and probably woman and herself, too.
And women and other women, because so many women, when they talk to each other and they say, oh my goodness, this, you're going through this also? I didn't know. I thought I was the only one. And that's what I really want to accomplish, is to get people talking about this and let people understand that this is a normal, natural life transition. And, you know, we have to roll with it, but we can still support each other.
Dr. Deborah Wagner is a developmental psychologist in private practice in Ridgewood, New Jersey. Her new book is called The Fifth Decade. Is it just my life or is it perimenopause? You can also read her blog at yourmentalhealth.info.
Still to come, a Midwestern farming family found an answer to their financial problems. Get healthy. That's next on The Health Show.
You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you may have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow.
You can start your own Health Show archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1293.
This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs. Chris Gosney and her husband were like most of their neighbors in northwestern Oklahoma, conventional farmers relying heavily on chemicals to produce their crops. But 15 years ago, in an effort to weather a difficult economic moment in agriculture, they stumbled into organic farming. This discovery blossomed into a lifelong commitment to healthy soil, healthy crops, healthy livestock, and healthy people. This piece was produced by This Land Press, Oklahoma's first new media company.
Anhydrous ammonia is a fairly common soil input prior to planting wheat. Recently in our hometown, there was a leaking valve to an anhydrous ammonia tank. all at once, there's, you know, law enforcement officials all over the place, and they're shutting down the roads. They're thinking about evacuating people from their homes. And then the very next day, that same chemical is deliberately applied to fields where there's going to be seeds planted and a plant's going to grow, and then that plant's going to be harvested. People say, you are what you eat. I'm Chris Gosney. My husband and I operate John's Farm. John's Farm is a sustainable, certified organic farm. We have about 300 head of livestock, 1,500 acres of wheat, and then we raise a little bit of organic alfalfa. We were conventional farmers for years and years. If we had a bug problem, why, we sprayed on an insecticide. If we had a huge weed problem, we sprayed on chemical to kill the weeds, and we used that anhydrous ammonia. We were doing what 99.9% of everybody in our county was doing, because there were only two organic farmers in Major County. There was an older gentleman, and that old fella had been farming organically all of his life. We would see more weeds in his fields than in ours or any of the other conventional farmers, and we couldn't figure that out. Why would you do that? We kind of thought that was silly. We actually thought that the standard for good farming was a clean field. We didn't understand that the soil was half dead. It's just that we thought it looked good. When 1996, a neighbor of ours, he asked us to take over his farming operation, and the one stipulation was that we would farm it organically. The economy of agriculture was poor. We watched many of our neighbors lose their farms, and we weren't far from it. And so we thought, well, you know what, maybe this organic thing. So we agreed to rent the fellow's land and start farming a little bit organically. And the very next year, here come the old gentleman. And one comment he made was, as long as I am alive and have any say, I want my farms to be organic. And he said to John, my health is declining, and since you rent that other guy's organic farm, I want you to rent mine too and farm it. So we took that one on. In a lot of ways, we have become what he represented. I have been asked many times, why is it that more people aren't transitioning and doing more of what you're doing? And I'm really not sure, but I know for us, we could see that a soil can actually rebuild itself if it's cared for in a sustainable way. And to think about that plant growing in healthy soil is going to produce healthy food. It's still a financial struggle. It may always be, I don't know. But the goal, the end goal, seems more worth it.
That story was produced by This Land Press. You can hear more at thislandpress.com.
The term practice guidelines is pretty self-explanatory, and they're everywhere in healthcare. The rise of evidence-based medicine has resulted in a considerable growth in the number of guidelines developed and issued over the past decade. In the October 2012 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry, Dr. Patrick Basut published an editorial suggesting that there is room for improvement in practice guidelines issued by the National Academy of Clinical Biochemistry. Dr. Basut is the head of the Department of Clinical Epidemiology and Biostatistics at the Academic Medical Center of the University of Amsterdam in the Netherlands. We spoke recently and talked about practice guidelines.
Well, practice guidelines are systematically developed statements to help healthcare professionals and their patients in making appropriate decisions in healthcare. These are statements that tell healthcare professionals what the best line of action is in their specific circumstances, and that way they're informative for patients as well, telling them what not to do and what to do in specific circumstances. And these practice guidelines used to be based on consensus, so on the seniority by senior people, but nowadays they are being developed based on the current best available evidence from the scientific literature.
And over the past few years, we've seen the number of practice guidelines grow. Why is that?
Well, there are a number of reasons, actually, that you can mention for that process. One is that it's no doubt that healthcare costs have been rising, and there have been several studies that pointed out practice variations. And that means that for one particular procedure is used very often in one area and far less often in another area without actually a clear indication for that difference. So these developments actually have started people to doubt whether healthcare professionals were behaving in an appropriate way. So practice guidelines could help to contain costs and reduce practice variability. Now, on the other hand, if you believe in evidence-based medicine, that healthcare practice should be based on the best available evidence, it's very difficult for an individual to be on top of the literature, to know about all of the research that has been done in a particular area. So practice guidelines actually can help to improve quality, reduce waste in healthcare, and at the same time being based on a synthesis of the current best available evidence from the scientific literature. So they can be a real help for the healthcare professionals and their patients.
Your editorial comments on an evaluation of guidelines developed for laboratory professionals. In that paper, the authors use the so-called AGREE process, or appraisal of guidelines for research and evaluation. What were the conclusions from that evaluation?
Yes, the authors have analyzed 11 guidelines that have been developed by the National Academy of Clinical Biochemistry. And their conclusion actually was not very positive in the sense that their conclusions said that the quality of these 11 guidelines was generally rather poor. Actually, they're using the AGREE instrument. They were forced to assign quite low scores for these guidelines, clinical biochemistry.
Well, how do you explain the poor state of those guidelines in clinical chemistry, in laboratory medicine?
Well, unlike actually for pharmaceuticals or for other types of interventions, there's usually very little direct evidence that links the actions of people in clinical chemistry and laboratory medicine to health outcomes of patients. So people actually usually do not get better from taking a laboratory test in itself. There should be other actions by other healthcare professionals. And if these people make the appropriate decisions, people would get better. So unlike, for example, other areas in medicine where we have randomized trials to guide practice, actually, there are very few randomized trials to guide practice in laboratory medicine. And that's why the people that have developed these guidelines in clinical biochemistry, I think, could not rely on a very firmly developed methodology for developing practice guidelines. And it's interesting to note that only the last guideline, actually the one on diabetes, actually received quite high scores by these investigators, by this Canadian group that used the AGREE instrument.
Well, finally then, let's look ahead. What needs to be done in order to improve the state of guidelines in laboratory medicine?
Well, the authors that did this analysis have a number of recommendations. And in general, their recommendation comes down to a more systematic method for developing practice guidelines. Because practice guidelines should be systematically developed statements to guide healthcare professionals, actually, which my response to your first question. So these guidelines in biochemistry and laboratory medicine should be developed in a more systematic way. And if that happens, actually, they probably will have more impact on laboratory medicine in general and will lead to better health outcomes in patients.
Dr. Patrick Basut is head of the Department of Clinical Epidemiology and Biostatistics of the Academic Medical Center of the University of Amsterdam in the Netherlands. You can read his editorial on guidelines in the October 2012 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry. That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org.
Want more? Then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org.
I'm Bob Barrett.
And I'm Dr. Nina Sachs.
Stay healthy and be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.